Welcome to Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, we have an open line now for you at 1-800-462-7413. And, of course, along with your calls, Zorba, some interesting topics to talk about.
That's right. Sex and heart attacks. So is having sex going to produce a heart attack for you? It's kind of an important thing to ask about, talk about, and we've got some interesting information on what the risk is and how to prevent that risk from happening.
Okay, Ann.
Study of conflicts, some disturbing news published in the Archives of Maternal Medicine, brought up in the New York Times and other things, having to do with the guidelines that panelists write, for instance, for cardiovascular disease, high blood pressure, cholesterol, and so on. Where is the conflict of interest? It is rampant, and what does that mean for what doctors actually give you in your office?
Okay, important stuff. What's our recipe?
Well, it's from Sherry, and it's her Hungarian applesauce. Now, I don't know what is Hungarian about this, but I happen to love homemade applesauce, and this is a dynamite recipe.
As Zorba says, from Sherry Hagen in Menominee, Michigan. 800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. But before we take our next call, Zorba, recently we had a Judge Zorba segment, as you'll recall. We heard from listener John Scribbins, who is an antique dealer in Richland Center. Not only a note, but Zorba, look.
Oh, my God.
John sends a
look
gavel for our next Zorba Judge segment. Let me present this to you.
I love it. Oh, this is wonderful. This looks like it's made of some sort of a fabulous plastic.
Fabulous plastic.
Like this is a fabulous plastic gavel. It's got a little inscription on it from 1977. So if it's older than 5 years, yeah, according to my kids, it's an antique. Well, thank you.
Well, I hope you're right thank about you. Plastic. It looks a little to me like it's illegal ivory, but I don't,
illegal ivory.
Think it is.
I rather doubt
that's yours.
That.
You
thank
keep
you.
It. Use it on I the next
to, oh,
Judge
thank,
Zorba
thank you
segment.
So much. Oh, thank you, thank you, thank you.
800-462-7413, again, our toll-free number. To the phones we go, Zorba, and a listener in Woodstock, Illinois. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help you?
Well, I am a 58-year-old, extremely healthy, moderately exercised female. I run 3 miles a day, 3 times a week, and then I yoga 2 days, you know, just to give an alternative.
Mm-hmm.
I've been having some problem with my left hip. I spent a ridiculous amount of money on my shoes. I've been fitted, and so, you know, I don't believe it's my shoes. I change them every 500 miles or so. But I get this ache in my left hip. I go to the chiropractor every 3 weeks. I've been to a naturopath, but I really haven't had much relief.
Mm-hmm. From this pain. I have a question. You change your shoes every 500 miles. It sounds like a car kind of a thing. So you keep track of how many miles. I don't have the foggiest idea how many miles I walk with my in my shoes. Is that because you run the same distance every day?
Well, yeah, actually, quite frankly, I mean, if I do the math, I can pretty well figure it out. But I'll usually get maybe a little twinge in my knee or an mm-hmm. ankle or something, and that'll trigger me to go
change
and get
it.
Another pair.
So in other words, you'll notice when the cushioning, because shoes are cushioned and they basically have spaces in them, air that you're going to push down on when you're actually walking. And like any other cushiony thing, it wears out over time. I mean,
right.
all you know, they all wear out over time. It's not just the outside, it's the inside also.
Yeah.
Now, let's talk about your hip. The problem may be in the hip, may not be
well,
in your shoe.
I was wondering, maybe, could it possibly be arthritis?
Well, there are two
like
things.
I've been fighting
the answer is right. You didn't want to say the A word, which is the arthritis word.
Mm-hmm.
But it could be arthritis. You know, I can, you know, I assume that you're over 39 and, you know, arthritis does run the older you get. But it also could be a trochanteric bursitis. And a trochanteric bursitis is the bursa is a fat pad, basically, between the muscle and the bone. And if you go to our website, Zorba.com, zorbapastor.org. We'll give you a link so you'll be able to see a little diagram of what a trochanteric bursitis is. And it could be that. So it's probably not from the foot or the shoe if you've changed it properly and you're not having major problems. I'd look in the hip. And a trochanteric bursitis is treated with heat or ice, whatever works, over-the-counter anti-inflammatories, two Aleve twice a daily for about a month. See if that gets rid of it. It often works. And if that doesn't work, a steroid injection into the bursa can be very, very effective. So this could be trochanteric bursitis. The other thing it could be, if it's not that, is actually some hip arthritis. And over-the-counter anti-inflammatories, as I said, two Aleve twice a day can be very effective for that.
You bet.
Thank you so much for your call.
Thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it.
Thank you for calling. 800-462-7413. It's toll-free. 800-462-7413. On we go, Zorba, to Dallas, Texas. Hi.
Hi.
What's up?
Well, about 3 years ago, I got very ill with double bacterial pneumonia, and apparently I was severely malnutritioned, but I obviously got over that, but what never went away was the severe joint pain and foot pain and the exhaustion. And I finally went to my doctor and I said, well, 3 years later, I can't still be healing. Can we do some more tests? And he did. And he came back and he said, well, you're severely vitamin D deficient. And so I started, he gave me 50,000 IUs once a week. And I started that, and darned if that pain didn't go away. And for the first time in 3 years, I have energy. But when I looked it up on the internet, it says vitamin D deficiency is a symptom. It's not necessarily a cause. You know, like maybe you're vitamin D deficient and that's all you need. It's usually a symptom of something else.
Mm-hmm.
And I had never heard of it.
That's not necessarily what it is. But I'll give you the skinny, wherever that phrase came from, on vitamin D. Mm-hmm. Now, several years ago, a study came out that showed that women who were vitamin D deficient were at an increased risk for cancer and maybe heart disease. And then other studies came out looking at the data, retrospective studies where they had vitamin D samples. And lo and behold, if you are vitamin D deficient, you appear to be 10 or 20% more likely to get breast cancer, colon cancer, maybe prostate cancer. We don't know. So there's a chicken and egg thing here. Is the vitamin D deficiency causing the cancer, for example, or is the cancer causing, you know, sort of precursor to cancer or vitamin D deficiency? We don't know. And so there's some long-term studies that are going on right now, double-blind controlled studies, standard of the industry. People are getting D, not getting D, huge studies, and it's going to be out probably in the next 3 years. It's not out now. So enter the question of whether or not people should be getting vitamin D. And what I'm recommending to people is they take 1,000 or 2,000 units every day. Why get tested? Why spend the money? Just assume you may be vitamin D deficient because you pee it out if you have too much vitamin D in you anyway. I've got a question. He's giving you, he or she is giving you 50,000 units?
Correct. Once a week.
Once a week. That's a super high dose.
No.
I mean, that's why
I was so, you know, how did I get this way and could it, with it alleviating the pain and exhaustion. I mean, that's great.
I'm not sure why it's relieving your pain and exhaustion.
I was going to say, is that connected?
No, I've not seen any connection. I want to ask about this doctor. Tell me a little bit about the doctor who you're seeing.
He's just a family practitioner. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he ran, like I said, I went in for the exhaustion and was hoping he could find something on the joint pain. Mm-hmm. And he just ran the tests and he called back with it. But, you know, when I called back with questions about the vitamin D, his nurse really couldn't answer any questions because I'm in the sun and I was taking 2,000 IUs a day. Mm-hmm.
There are a couple of things I would suggest here, but I question whether or not you need to be on 50,000 units. I mean, that's a lot of units, and I question that, because it doesn't make sense to me. So one of the things I would consider doing is going back on 2,000 units or 3,000 units a day, and having your blood tested, you know, after a couple of months, and see what your vitamin D level is. Period. That's number one. Number two, second opinion. always okay to get a second opinion. You know, second blood test in another lab, another doctor, second opinion. But 50,000 units, it's a fat. Vitamin D is a fat-soluble vitamin, so we tend to store it. That's a lot of units. That's a lot of units. Okay.
All right. I will go back and ask more questions.
You know something? That's exactly why it's important to listen to public radio. You hit it right there. You're going to go back. You're going to ask more questions. And as a result, you're going to get better medical care. And it's very interesting because health literacy, the ability to listen to information, take it in, ask questions, ends up producing better outcomes and longevity. So what you just said and did is the whole reason that Tom and I are on this show. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too.
Thank you so much for the call. Again, 800-462-7413. Now, Zorba, let's talk about sex.
Yes, let's talk about sex. Here we are. Everything you wanted to know about sex. Well, you know, a question that has actually come up time and time again has been, you know, if you don't exercise at all and you engage in sex and get your heart going, are you going to have a heart attack?
Yeah. Can you have a heart attack from having sex?
Yeah. Can you have a heart attack from having sex? And the answer is yes. Mm-hmm. You can have a heart attack. This was an article that actually looked at the incremental risk of having a heart attack with sex and other exercise. We're going to put into the exercise category. Gets the heart going. Gets the muscles pounding and so on. You've got hormones that are going through the body and you're engaging in activity. And basically, the risk of a heart attack is actually probably about 2 to 3 times, probably in that 3 range, higher during the act of sex than before you actually engage in the act of sex. And that, of course, that risk is incrementally increased if you do not exercise.
Oh.
So in other words, for the non-exerciser who is getting, we'll say, older at that heart attack risk age, 50, we'll put it just at the age of 50 for guys, if they are lazy and slothful and they have no exercise except occasional sex, while they're engaged in the act of coitus, they are at risk for having a heart attack, which is kind of a bummer to think about when you're actually engaged in sex.
People don't tend to think of that.
I don't think people think about death when they're actually engaged in sex, because if they do, they're probably not going to be engaged in sex. But there is an answer to this. There's an answer to this. And this is, you know, for men and women. It's not, you know, for both. The answer is exercise. So in other words, if you want to have sex, start walking. Start jogging. Start getting on the treadmill. Start going on the elliptical. Consider swimming. In other words, just consider some exercise so that you don't have that incremental risk. And that might be very useful.
So you need to make the decision. Do you want the sex?
That's right. That's
right. If you do, then you have to do
the exercise. Then you have to exercise. That's exactly. So I look at this as another carrot, another reason to engage in regular exercise. Hi, honey. I'm going out to jog so we can have sex tonight. Something like that. And put that in your armamentarium. Good article. I think it's going to change America once Americans realize they've got to exercise to have sex. I think we're going to slim down and buff up.
Let's hope. 800-462-7413. And Zorba, a listener with us now in St. Charles, Missouri. Hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Fine. How can we help?
Well, thanks for the show. It's a national treasure as far as I'm concerned.
Aren't
and,
you nice?
I'm a 59-year-old male about to be 60. And over the years, periodically, I'd get PSA tests. Used to be down about 2, 1, 2, 2, 2, 3. Then I went several years and get one, and then I recently got one last July. It was 3.1. And then so I was sent to a urologist, and he wanted to do a biopsy, but because of insurance, it was towards the end of the year, and my deductible is an annual deal, so I kind of postponed. And the more I found out about this, it seems to be a lot of basically controversy around the whole PSA issue. And so I waited till the first year, then I got another PSA, which I think was a flawed test, but it was 5.0, and so now my urologist was going crazy. And so I kind of hemmed and hawed about it, and I waited about another month, and since then I've gotten three tests, and they're all back around 3.2. I also had a free PSA, and that was at 19.9. So the doctor is still urging me to get a biopsy, but you know, it kind of, I think there's some issues there as far as side effects and whatnot. And I'm just kind of wondering what the doctor would think about the whole thing, you know, mm-hmm. before they turn my poor little prostate into a pincushion.
Yeah, and before Zorba answers that, educate us again, Zorba, on PSA tests.
Well, PSA, by the way, I like the concept. I like the pincushion. Yeah. Metaphor. It's great. That's exactly what it is, because when they do a biopsy, they go through your rectum and take these little samples out of your prostate. It's very interesting. I called the PSA test when the guidelines some of the guidelines came out the Urologist Employment Act because you know elevated PSA need a biopsy, and that's what urologists say. They automatically need a biopsy. Now, if we look at the data, there's a lot of interesting data. It is a controversial test. Why? Well, probably 30 to 40% of all prostate cancer men who have it. Have a normal PSA. And 34 to 40% of all those who have an abnormal PSA don't have prostate cancer. If we look at men, we'll say 60 years of age and older, about 50% of them have prostate cancer. It's there. It's sitting there not doing anything. 50% of the men, let me repeat that, have prostate cancer and it does nothing at all. What happens is we then try to decide who is going to need a biopsy and make a rational decision. You've now had more prostate tests than you need to have. So we've got a lot of data there. There's no reason to get another prostate test. It was probably elevated because you had a swollen prostate from either some prostatitis or from, you've got an enlarged prostate. And sometimes it just produces more, you know, of this PSA antigen that we measure. Undoubtedly, that's what it was. That one test was a little bit out. 3.1, not a highly elevated prostate. Could you have prostate cancer? Yes, you could have one. How do we rule it out? Well, we take these little random biopsies from the lobe, and if it's negative, then we do it again a month later or a year later or 2 years later. I think you've got enough numbers. So if you were my patient, I would sit there with you. You and I would make a decision, and you might follow it up with another test in a year. Because prostate cancer for most men is a very slow-growing cancer. That's what it is.
Well, and there's another issue. In my case, I'm an airline pilot, and if they were to find a minuscule amount of a problem there, then suddenly I'm grounded.
Oh, so in other words, if they find a prostate cancer on biopsy, you're not allowed to fly. You're not allowed to pilot an airplane.
Until you fix it.
Oh, until you fix it. Oh, see.
What a stupid rule.
It's mandatory. Then you get into, do you do the radiation? Do you do the radical?
Right.
You know.
Right.
So on and so
right.
forth.
I think I would get it checked in 6 months to a year. But you don't get it checked sooner. There's no reason. You've got plenty of data. You've got a good data stream. And I'd go to your family doc, your primary care doctor, discuss it with them, and just follow it that way.
Okay, great.
Good luck.
Well, thanks very much.
We appreciate the call. Isn't that a dumb rule?
Yes, there are dumb rules in this world.
I mean, here I'm a pilot.
Right.
Oh, my God.
Right.
Collapsed because of my prostate.
Suddenly. Yeah. Suddenly collapse because you're because you've got microscopic cancer in your prostate. Yeah.
Didn't he sound like a pilot?
Oh, of course he did. Absolutely. He was all ready to say, and in 2 minutes, we're going to land in JFK Airport.
Boy, he had a pilot voice.
He had that pilot voice, absolutely.
Before we take a break, Zorba, let's take a moment for a listener tip. On a recent program, we were helping a young woman out who was suffering from headaches every time she did ab workouts. You asked her what kind of exercises she was doing. Well, she told us that she was working with an exercise ball called a BOSU. Then she joked that she had renamed it the Bozo Ball for all of the pain it was causing her. Well, one woman's quip was another's clue. Janet from Milwaukee has a helpful theory for our caller based on that remark. Perhaps it's a rubber allergy. Janet had similar issue and found that she had an allergy to rubber and the exercise ball was not helping. Janet recommends avoiding the exercise ball to avoid more headaches.
Oh, that's a great
idea.
Isn't
that interesting?
Yeah, very interesting. But now what if you want to use the exercise ball? What would you do? What would you do if you have a rubber allergy and you really wanted to use the exercise ball?
You mean in lieu of the exercise ball?
Yeah.
Well, it's for ab stuff usually.
Yeah. Well, so maybe you could cover it. You could make a pillow
cover. But you can do floor exercises for abs.
You could do other things. Yeah, you could do other exercises. Yeah, yeah. I'd make a pillow. I'd make a little zipper pillow so I would do it. it because I like
ball in a pillow.
Yeah, I put the ball in a pillow, and I bet you can find those on the web. Don't you think? I bet you can find Bosu ball web covers for those with rubber.
If you can't
allergies.
Now, you'll be able to in a little. 10 minutes.
10 minutes. Exactly. And she got it.
Well, bounce away your lifestyle problems by sending them to the show. Just send your email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have a recipe coming up, a listener recipe from a listener in Menominee, Michigan. Lots more of your calls, some more research to talk over, and of course, our medical myth buster. Lots of great reasons for you to stay with us here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health, a national treasure, one of our listeners does that, from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our telephone number is 800-462-7413. You can use that if you have a question for Zorba. But before we take our next call, we will welcome Sherry Hagan of Menominee, Michigan, who has our recipe of the week. Sherry, hi.
Hi.
Good to have you here. Tell us about Sherry's Hungarian applesauce. First off, how'd you come up with this?
Well, I was really getting into spices over the last few years, and I planted spices in my garden, you know, the kind of herbs like basil and thyme, oregano, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I called a friend of mine. I asked her for where I could find a good spice cookbook, and she recommended one. It was like 1964 printing. It's called The Spice Cookbook. Looked it up on the library system, couldn't find it. Realized I had lots of cookbooks, and I had another shelf of cookbooks in the other room. Looked on that shelf, and there was the cookbook. And I had a lot of apples, so I was looking for a recipe using apples, and then I tracked down the Hungarian applesauce, and I noticed it had nutmeg in it and sour cream, and I thought that would be an interesting recipe to try, and didn't like the amount of sugar in it, so I cut the sugar down and started making it.
So you modified it, and yes. It came out really, really well.
Yes, my husband and my 16-year-old son likes it, and I also tried it out on his 16-year-old friend, and he liked it as well.
Okay.
What kind of apples do you use? This is always a point of discussion, you know, certainly on our show, because apples have different uses.
Here's a caveat.
Give the caveat, Tom.
Nobody has ever used the Red Delicious apple in cooking, and you shouldn't use it in cooking. I will acknowledge that.
You will acknowledge.
Even though I enjoy eating it.
You like the Red Delicious. Yeah. Apple.
But not in cooking.
But not in cooking.
Okay.
And not in applesauce. So now that we've given that caveat, what kind of apple do you use, or do you care?
Well, to begin with, we very seldom get Red Delicious apples because we don't even like eating them here.
Way to go.
Someone sorry about that, Tom.
Okay, that's a vote for
someone
Zorba.
Someone on my side.
You have a lot of people on your side.
The tasteless Red Delicious apple.
Well, what I do is I kind of look at what apples that I have a lot of, and I do, you know, shopping at various stores, and I often buy Gala apples. But
Galas are great.
Yeah, and then I also have Macintosh. But the bottom line is, what apples do I have too many of?
Right, and I think when it comes to applesauce, that's kind of a good way to look at it. What's on sale during apple time? What do you have too much of? Because you know, what you're going to do is add things and change it to them. You're not just eating the fruit; you're altering the fruit. My wife likes a more tart apple, like a Granny Smith. Gosh, who knows where these names come from? I happen to like a sweeter apple, the Honeycrisp. My mouth waters when I think about it, which is a new variety, and it was wonderful. Michael Pollan's book, by the way, which is called The Botany of Desire, he talks about apples and what they were originally used for. You know what apples were originally? I mean, there really was a Johnny Appleseed who went around selling saplings. He didn't sell seeds because you don't grow apples from seeds. And you know what apples were used for in those days?
I thought it was for horses.
They were used for cider.
He brought the gift of alcohol
to the countryside, and apple orchards were basically where people bought apples and then made hard cider, and that's how they whiled away the winter. And an apple a day keeps the doctor away was invented in the late 1800s because the Women's Christian Temperance League was chopping down these trees, and the apple growers were furious and had to come up with a slogan. An apple a day keeps the doctor away, which is good for bulk. It's good for constipation, so
sure,
I agree with
sure.
that. Okay, so let's get away from the politics of apples into the cooking. You start out with 8 medium cooking apples, whatever's around.
Whatever's around. And the bottom line, if you're using a harder apple, it's just going to take longer to cook. And when I'm making the recipe, basically what I like about it is you just quarter the apple. You peel it, quarter it, you know, take the core seeds or whatever, and then you start cooking it, and you just check it. And when those quarters are starting to lose their shape, that's when you do the rest of the recipe, when you add some flour and additional sugar and that type of thing. So it's just a matter of checking it. And you can use any kind of flour you want to, because I tend to go gluten-free because I just feel better. So I just use my gluten-free flour.
That is a great tip. That is a great tip. How do you peel your apples?
I just use one of those regular apple peelers, and unless my son wants to come down and use his special apple peeler,
What's his special apple peeler?
Oh, it's one of those apple peelers that you stick the apple on, and then you crank it, and then the peeling comes off.
Yeah, I've got one of those in the basement. Do they work? I've never been able to get mine to.
Oh, they can. They're more entertaining than
That's what I have found,
saving.
Too. I have found they're more entertaining if I'm going to peel an apple. It's exactly. Just checking. I wondered if you had a tip for the apple peeler. So.
No.
A cup of water. Really simple. 1 cup of water, 2 tablespoonfuls of flour. I take it that's white flour.
It's white flour. And when I divide the sugar up, I will take and add the quarter cup sugar with the flour. And then I'll add the remaining sugar later in the recipe.
Okay, and we'll talk about that when we actually do the recipe. We do use 1 cup of sugar.
Yes.
Teaspoon of ground nutmeg. Now, when you use ground nutmeg, do you use the nutmeg that is already ground and dried, or do you take the nutmeg, you know, the little nut?
Well, I don't tend to have the little nut on hand. I take the regular ground. I buy it from a Mennonite bulk food store.
Oh, good, 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 good.
Oh, yeah.
Quarter teaspoon of salt and 1/2 cup of low-fat sour cream. Very interesting. Sour cream. So you've got sweet on one hand, sour on the other. Cream, I don't think I've ever had applesauce with sour cream. Okay,
good.
So that is good. You added that, or that was part of the recipe as you mixed it?
That's part of the recipe, and I'm not Hungarian. I don't know if Hungarian and nutmeg and sour cream traditionally goes together, but I thought it was kind of a different recipe, and I happen to have sour cream on hand.
I don't think, Tom, are you Hungarian? Any Hungarian in your
family? No, I'm not.
No, Tom is no Hungarian. I don't know. Nobody in our crew is Hungarian, and they're not speaking it. It's a strange language, but we won't go there. Okay, wash and peel the apples, then cut into quarters and remove the cores. Place in a saucepan with water. Cook and cover until they're tender. So he said until the quarters begin to sort of change
a bit.
They start looking mushy. Not falling into pieces, just looking mushy. Then you mix the flour, that's the 2 tablespoonfuls of flour, with 1/4 of the cup of sugar, and add that to the apples. Mix it around and cook it until it's thickened. And then, after that, you stir in the remaining sugar, nutmeg, salt, and sour cream, and you serve it warm or cold. How is this warm? Sounds
good.
Great.
It tastes like kind of an apple pudding.
Ooh, it sounds delicious.
Great,
you know, I like this. I like this. Simple recipe, which is wonderful. 200 calories coming from that. It's a really great recipe. It's a little bit of protein, not much at all. I think it's a wonderful recipe that our listeners will love. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thanks so much, Sherry. And for sending us this winning recipe, Sherry gets a free copy of our cookbook, Heart Healthy, Low-Fat, Guilt-Free, and Tasty Recipes from the Kitchen of Zorba Pastor. And if you want to enter our recipe contest, it's really easy. Just email your original low-fat recipe to us at
Zorba@WPR.org.
And if you want a copy of today's recipe, visit our website at
ZorbaPastor.org. And while you're at it, you can sign up for our weekly recipe podcast and search all of your favorite recipes. That's ZorbaPastor.org, or you can find us on Facebook.
+1 800 462 7413 is our toll-free number. Question for Zorba? 800-462-7413. And now Zorba, listener with us in Branson, Missouri. Hello.
Hi.
Thanks for calling. What's up?
Well, my five-year-old daughter, she's having problems with irritable bowel. We've taken her to the doctor for the last 2 years, and the doctors really haven't seemed to do much about it, except for to medicate. I'm trying to find out if there's any other options or maybe a diet that I should try or, you know, what I should go from there.
For 2 years, she's had this problem.
Yeah, she's having a lot of problem with it. Lots of vomiting and lots of, you know, real soft or almost diarrhea bowel. And it gets worse, especially if we're in the car.
That's tough with a five-year-old.
What sort of medicine are they giving her?
You know, I couldn't tell you right offhand, but I do know that it's like a fiber tablet, a chewable tablet.
Mm-hmm. Okay, chewable fiber type tablet, not something for spasm. Okay, let's go back to her food. Is she eating normally, or is she having a variety of foods, or has she limited herself to just a few different foods?
No, we try to have as healthy as we can with greens and vegetables and, you know, and stuff like that. We try to stay away from the potatoes and meat.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
okay.
We'll have chicken and that kind of thing, but... just pretty basic.
Pretty basic. Milk and dairy products, you've removed those from her diet or not?
We have tried that, and it didn't make any difference at all.
Okay, because that's one of the things we automatically look at for irritable bowel syndrome, is a lot of people do not basically digest the milk, sugar, lactose, and they can't do it. You know, and so it's very hard to get rid of dairy in our society, especially with kids, because we have so many milk-based products. Now, she's seen a gastroenterologist or not? Who is she seeing?
She's not seeing one because with my insurance, she has to be referred over. And
okay.
The doctor that we've had, actually the last three doctors, have not found the need to send her to that.
That's what she needs. Irritable bowel syndrome is what we call a wastebasket diagnosis. It's a diagnosis of exclusion. If it's not this, it's not X, it's not Y, it's not Z, then it must be irritable bowel syndrome. In a five-year-old, that is an unusual diagnosis. Now, lactose intolerance, inability to digest either milk protein or sugar, that's not an unusual diagnosis, and you've tried it, but I am not comfortable with her diagnosis at this point, and she needs a gastroenterologist. Now, why your doctor hasn't referred you to a gastroenterologist, that's the really important question.
I can't
question.
Imagine. 2 years this has been going on.
Yeah. Yeah. And so they've said, no, we're not going to refer you to this gastroenterologist?
Well, they said that it could be her diet and the way she exercises, which this, you know, a five-year-old has a lot of exercise.
Yeah.
And it's to the point where we actually had to remove her from pre-K to the school because I was getting called 2 or 3 times a day to come get her. So
she's not going to school at this time. She's at home.
No. She has to stay home.
Okay. Well, you need a second opinion. And I'll tell you something that kind of I wonder about here is whether or not in your particular insurance plan, whether or not the doctor's referral to the gastroenterologist is reflects the doctor's bottom line of how much reimbursement they get. In other words, if they refer too much to too many specialists, do they take home less money? And if that's the case, that's not the right way to make a decision on a referral. That's not really the ethically right way. She has the symptoms of diarrhea that are debilitating, period. Until you see a gastroenterologist and until you have a number of tests done, has she had stool samples to see if she has an infection?
Yes, and that was actually done 2 weeks ago. And they said that there was nothing.
Okay, so the first time this was done, she's had this problem for 2 years, but she's only had one stool sample 2 weeks ago?
Yes.
That's, you need to get another doctor and another opinion, and you need to see a gastroenterologist. She's not getting good care. That's very clear to me, and you don't have a diagnosis. And if she's out of school, that's a serious thing. I think once you get a diagnosis, then you can get a treatment that can be very worthwhile. There are lots of things you can do for this.
Okay.
Good luck. Let us know. Please let us know what happens.
Absolutely.
And thank you so much for the call.
You know, sometimes I think one of the important things that we do on the show is we lead people to the fact that they're satisfied with their medical opinion. And what happens is sometimes they just have to say, oh, my gosh, I have to get another opinion somewhere else. And this is just a good example of, you know, something that I'm sure that father is immediately going to go back and say, I've got to go and get another opinion for my daughter. Mm-hmm.
We have an interesting topic coming up, lots more of your questions, and of course our medical myth buster, right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our toll-free number again is 800-462-7413. But before our next call, some troubling info on doctor's panels, Zorba.
Right. And it is troubling. And what we have to do is we have to try to figure out how to sort of fix it. And this has to do with conflicts of interest by the physicians who write guidelines.
Yeah.
Okay, so guidelines. Guidelines are basically the kind of the tools that we use, the recipes that we use to determine when we're going to start a cholesterol drug, when we're going to start an osteoporosis drug, how low we're going to lower the blood pressure, what drugs we're going to use.
Mm-hmm.
And this particular study, published in the Archives of Internal Medicine, good journal, prestigious, showed that 56%, more than half of those who wrote the 17 guidelines for the American Heart Association, blood pressure guidelines, cholesterol, and so on, had conflicts. And if we looked at it, 81% had personal financial interests in the companies that may have been affected by the guidelines.
So we have to worry at least a little bit about whether doctors are really doing what's good for us.
Well, that's exactly it, the guidelines. Now, we have to look at what these personal financial interests are. And you know, the first personal financial interest may be that they were hired as a consultant from the company.
Mm-hmm.
You know, okay, so they're hired by a consultant. They may own some stock in the company. That may be a personal financial interest. They may be on what are called advisory boards so that they're promoting the drug and so on.
Yeah.
And the reason why this is important is when we're having guidelines, you want to find physicians who do not have personal financial interests.
Yeah.
And that kind of ought to be one of the things that you would expect. Now, there's nothing wrong with having a financial interest in a drug company, but I think there's something wrong if you have a financial interest in a drug company and then you're writing the guideline where you may be recommending that
drug. But, of course, you want the very, very best people writing these guidelines.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
It may be a little tough to find these very, very best people who don't have some sort of conflict.
That's exactly the side. Now, if you look, for instance, at the New England Journal of Medicine or JAMA, they basically all have pharmaceutical company sponsorship. They place ads in those journals. I mean, there's no doubt about it. Well, where's the conflict of interest? Well, they don't determine what goes in the journals. They just place ads in the journals. So I think, this is a wake-up call to say we've got to look at the guidelines and we have to say what are the rules that are in place. But you're right. It's really not that simple.
Yeah. So what do we do?
Well, I think what happens is this is going to change the course of things. I think that the physicians have to declare what their conflict of interest is, and then I think you have to have guidelines as to what is the conflict of interest. Is it a speaking tour? Is it an advisory board? Is it a financial interest in the stock? And we have to clean this up.
800-462-7413, our toll-free number. Now, Zorba, let's see if we can help a listener in Sheridan, Wyoming. Hi.
Hello. Hi, Zorba. Hi, Tom.
Hi, what's up?
Well, I am training for a 30K mountain run. I'm 59 years old, and I would really like to be able to win my age group because I'll be at the top of my age bracket. But I have a problem with my foot. I have a Morton's neuroma on my foot, and it's really been bothering me. The pain has gotten more intense, and the longer I run, the more problematic it is. So I'm wondering if Zorba knows anything about treatment for that. I've read about an injection of alcohol into that neuroma that is supposed to be a cure, and I just wanted Zorba's thoughts on that.
Yeah, before he gives them, give us some info on a 30K mountain run. It sounds impossible to me.
Well, I thought it would be impossible as well. I've done the race a few times in the past. It's actually an ultra marathon, so there are people that come from all over the United States to run 100 miles. There's a 50-mile run. There's a full marathon. And I will be doing the shortest leg of the race at about 18.6 miles.
And what kind of elevation is there?
Well, we start in the Bighorn Mountains. I don't know just exactly how high it is, and it's mostly a downhill run, and it's a very demanding race. But it's beautiful, beautiful mountain scenery and wonderful spirit associated with the race and camaraderie with other runners. And I would really like to be able to do well.
It sounds fantastic. It sounds like it's just a wonderful thing to do. And a Morton's neuroma is no fun. Now, a neuroma means a swelling of the nerve. And the Morton's neuroma is a swelling of the nerve, basically, between two of the toes. Is this between the third and the fourth toe?
Yes, it is.
And that's the most common place where it is. And what happens is every time you sort of push on the neuroma, it causes pain. And it's in a sensory nerve that's around the toe. And the pain can be very, very uncomfortable. It's called an entrapment syndrome. So the nerve is entrapped, and it fires when it shouldn't fire, and it hurts you when it shouldn't hurt you. And when your toes are compressed when you're running and you're doing the push-off for the run, it can really hurt. So does it bother you when you're racing?
It bothers me the longer I go, and so it's not a problem on my shorter training runs, but as I go on long, put in more mileage, it starts to bother me.
Right. It's then more and more difficult. Well, a couple suggestions. First of all, Morton's neuroma sometimes actually do respond to different injections. One injection is alcohol. I think it's a 20% alcohol solution that can destroy the neuroma completely. Another one sometimes is a steroid solution, steroids with a bit of xylocaine, which are put right into the neuroma, that also can make things a little bit better and not be quite as painful or uncomfortable. And that's what I would try first. The other thing you can do of a more architectural manner would be to wear a shoe where you basically allow your feet to fan a little bit more. And you can do that by either a larger shoe box, that's sort of where your toes are at the end of the shoe, or by sort of making the laces a little bit less tight in that part. Or you can take a Dr. Scholl's, I don't know, but they're toe separators. They go in between the toes, and they push the toes apart a little bit. And that may help you, too, between the third and the fourth, or the second and the third toe. And I think I'd try those things first. And then if they fail, there's a simple surgery to remove the nerve.
Well, thank you so much. Yeah. I'm just thrilled to be able to talk with you and Tom.
Yeah, thanks. Have you ever won your age?
I have. I have placed. I've gotten either first or second in my age group in the past. And now that I'm at the top end of my age group, I would really like to come out number one.
Oh, that is great. That is great. Always trying for your personal best, I think, is a great way, especially when it comes to something such as an athletic event. So
yeah, not only your personal best, but better than everybody else.
Yeah, better than everyone else's personal best. There you got it.
All right. Well, thanks so much for the call.
We appreciate it. Thank you. 800-462-7413, our toll-free number. Zorba, let's get to our medical myth buster now. Today's myth deals with a common culprit, the cell phone. The cell phone has been the centerpiece to a lot of medical myths, including cancer. But there's a new theory floating around that cell phones could be causing allergic reactions. Is this true?
Yes. It all depends on the cell phone. It's not that cell phones cause allergic reactions. But what's on top of the cell phone can be the issue when you hold it up to the shiny stuff that looks like metal? I mean, it is metal. Sometimes it's plastic. But if it's metal,
You mean the casing of the cell phone?
Mm-hmm. Casing of the head. So you hold it up to your ear. And if it's a metal casing, that metal is more likely than not to be nickel.
All right.
And nickel, about 5% of the male population and about 20% of the female population is allergic to nickel.
Really?
Because nickel is in jewelry. It's what makes a lot of jewelry shiny is actually nickel plate. Hmm. And nickel is a common metal allergen. And for example, when people wear blue jeans and they have a metal button on their blue jean, they often will get a nickel allergy to this metal button if it's directly onto their skin. And that allergic reaction is from the nickel that's on the button. The answer is it's the nickel in that may produce the shininess in the phone that produces the allergy, and it's a nickel allergy. Yeah. So you're not allergic to the phone.
What causes a rash?
Can cause a rash, and so we're seeing that because people hold up their cell phone, they hold it up to their ear, and they're rubbing this nickel along their ear, along the skin, and they go, "What's this rash on my ear?" And it's basically from the nickel. And sometimes it's very difficult to find because you'll say to people, "I don't know what this rash is from. You know, is there anything on there, you know, that you're holding up to your ear?" And you look at it and you go, "Well, no, I don't hold anything up to the ear," because I don't think about it, right? You don't think about a phone.
If you're under, say, 17, it's on your ear all the time.
It's on your ear all the time. No, that's what
it's part of your body.
It's part of your body. Walking down the street. Let's go on a little further. There's a tendonitis that occurs on your hand that you're holding it down.
Yeah,
it's called cell phone tendonitis. It used to be tennis elbow, golfer's elbow. Now it's cell phone elbow.
Yeah.
And I know this for sure because I had wrist discomfort from holding up my phone to my ear. I was developing some pain and discomfort at the base of my thumb and my wrist, so I went to a Bluetooth. It's gone away.
Yeah.
And I didn't even have to pay my copay because I'm my own doctor.
Well, if you have a myth you'd like to bust, don't phone it in. Just send us an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Our number again is 800-462-7413. And our next caller, Zorba, is in Duluth, Minnesota. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help?
Well, I have a piece of alternative medicine, it may be called, or it also may be called folk remedies. I'm wondering if Zorba knows anything about the properties of a wart penny.
What do you mean?
A wart penny?
What's a wart penny?
A wart penny. Well, I know, Zorba, one of your great, great cures for warts and even planter's warts is duct tape, then. My son also adheres to that that treatment, that cure. He's used it a lot. But a lot of the old Scandinavian women, Scandinavian ethnicity, even some of the Slavics up here in northeastern Minnesota, speak of the properties of a wart penny, where like you will get a wart on your finger or on your hands, and they will give you a penny, and if you rub this penny on that wart once, maybe twice a day, in a very short amount of time, that wart will disappear and be gone.
Hmm.
Now, I believe that warts are what, viral or bacterial?
Mm-hmm. Viral.
And I was wondering if there was something in the chemistry of the penny that caused them to disappear, or if it was just purely coincidence.
Something about copper that would...
Uh-huh. That would actually do it. Well, does it work for a lead penny? You know, the lead pennies that were like the 1944 penny.
I've not tried a lead penny, I do have a wart penny, wheat penny.
How about a wooden nickel?
Wooden nickel.
A wooden nickel. First of all, the real thing about warts is they come and they go when we do nothing. In other words, they have a natural history of a year and a half to 2 years. I recently went to a wonderful continuing medical education lecture about warts, and 50% of the warts, when we treat them, will go away with treatment, and the other 50% will go away with no treatment. And so the question is, why do we engage in any treatment? We basically try to destroy the top of the wart, and then eventually the body actually, through its immune system, usually actually gets rid of the wart. So the wart pennies may have worked. On the other hand, nothing may have worked too. And I think that's one of the reasons why we see so many wart cures for so many different things. So I think if the penny works and you're Scandinavian, you should use it. And if you're of another ethnicity, you have to decide whether or not it fits within your cultural milieu of whether or not you're going to use it. The duct tape works probably just because it covers the wart, and that irritation produces some anti-inflammatory response that then gets rid of the wart. And that's probably where duct tape actually works. And it doesn't really have to be duct tape. It's really any tape that'll work. But yeah. Duct tape just sticks better because of whatever those ducts use to put on the tape.
So it isn't anything to do with chemistry and copper?
I don't think it's the copper chemistry. Okay. I think what happens is they rub the wart with the penny, and then the body develops an inflammatory response. Okay. Now, how many times do they swipe the wart with the penny?
When I get in close proximity to some of those old Scandinavian women, I'll ask them what their technique is, and I'll be sure to send it along.
Please, and we need to know that, but it has to be in English. Can't be in Norwegian.
No Polish or Swedish. Huh?
You got it. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for the call. Before we punch out for the week, Zorba, we have a PSA from the Zorba Pastor on Your Health Grammar Police. Not too long ago, you were helping a caller with trigger thumb, and we wondered why it was called trigger finger or trigger thumb. Well, you put out a call to the Zorba Pastor on Your Health Grammar Police, and they responded. Self-proclaimed medical word specialist Diane fills in the blanks. Do you think that's like the CSI of the grammar police world? Deputy Diane writes, when there's a knot on the tendon that sticks in the fascia surrounding the tendon, it takes an extra pull to get it through, such as pulling a trigger.
That's right. That's right. You think that's where it comes from?
No.
No, not at all.
I don't think so. I don't believe
that. I think it's because of the click. I think it's just a little click. You know, it's the kiss. It's simple. Keep it simple. I think it's just a little click. Not every, but you know what I like about the grammar police?
What?
They're always around, and they're always have an opinion about things. And I love that. You know, it's freedom of speech in America. Go, America. Go. That's what I love.
So if you want to risk Zorba's wrath by joining the Zorba Pastor and your Health Grammar Police, you can do it by sending an email to
Zorba@WPR.org. And thank you, Grammar Police. Keep up the good work. Keep those emails coming.
See you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our recipe podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org.
Don't forget, you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. Adam Red Friedrich and Brad Yellow Kohlberg are the two angry birds responsible for producing this hour when they're not saving the world from the evil green pigs. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping you'll be with us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0409Z. More on healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, show archives, and listener feedback, is available online at ZorbaPastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.